Okay, let's unpack this. For many, Marc Maron is a familiar voice, right? A constant presence across stand-up, podcasts, acting. Today, we're diving into a fascinating individual whose career path is less of a straight line and more of a, well, a profoundly personal, often circuitous, but ultimately successful journey. The sources you've brought us offer a truly comprehensive look at his evolution, from a young, ambitious comic navigating the, the rough and tumble clubs, to a cultural icon who truly exemplifies the power of authenticity and reinvention. Our mission isn't just to trace a biography. We're here to explore a kind of blueprint for how personal struggles, near misses, even outright rejections, can not only fuel artistic triumphs, but fundamentally reshape the modern media landscape. We're excited to guide you through the most important insights from this incredible material.
Yeah, and what's truly remarkable about Marc Maron is how his career embodies this unique, almost accidental intersection of traditional and new media. His story isn't just about individual success, it's a profound case study in how personal vulnerability, when channeled effectively, can forge incredibly deep, almost intimate connections with an audience. I mean, just consider the sheer scale of his impact. WTF with Marc Maron, his flagship podcast, boasts over 600 million downloads. That's huge. And he's garnered significant recognition in both the comedy world and the broader audio landscape, even earning a spot in the Library of Congress for that Robin Williams episode. Beyond Maron's individual path, his trajectory offered crucial insights into the power of finding and owning your own platform, especially after experiencing repeated friction and, frankly, rejection from established systems. It's a narrative that speaks to the true democratizing potential of new media, showing how an authentic voice can break through no matter the gatekeepers.
Okay, so let's start right at the very beginning, laying the groundwork for this remarkable journey. Marc David Maron was born September 27th, 1963, in Jersey City, New Jersey. But his childhood wasn't rooted in one place. He lived in Wayne, New Jersey, until he was six. Then, because his father, Barry Ralph Maron, an orthopedic surgeon, joined the U.S. Air Force for his residency, the family moved to Alaska for 2 years. Imagine that shift. East Coast to, well,
Talk
Alaska.
about a change of scenery.
Right. After his father left the Air Force, they moved again, this time to Albuquerque, New Mexico. And Marc spent his formative years there, from third grade all the way through high school, graduating from Highland High School. He comes from a Jewish family, roots in Poland and Ukraine, and he has a younger brother, Craig. These big geographical shifts, this sort of constant uprooting, it feels like a defining characteristic of his early life. And for someone who would later become such a renowned interviewer and storyteller, it certainly tracks that he graduated from Boston University in 1986 with a BA in English literature. That academic background in storytelling and critical analysis, it must have informed his later approach to both comedy and conversation.
You've highlighted something critical there. These formative years, marked by such varied geographical and cultural influences, almost certainly laid the groundwork for a comedian later known for such, well, deep self-revelation and incisive cultural analysis. Moving from the dense East Coast to the vastness of Alaska, then to the unique cultural landscape of the Southwest, that could very well have fostered a really keen observational sensibility, maybe a feeling of being an outsider looking in, which is often, a key trait in comedians. It kind of compels you to constantly analyze new environments and people.
Makes sense.
And having an orthopedic surgeon for a father, along with his mother, Toby Blum, it might seem like an unusual background for an artist, but it potentially gave him a unique, perhaps even a slightly clinical perspective on human physicality, resilience, and the sometimes absurd mechanics of our lives. These early shifts, combined with his English lit studies, would have undoubtedly shaped his worldview, refining his ability to deconstruct narratives and probably contributing to that introspective nature he'd become famous for.
So, with that foundation, how did it all translate into his early comedy? He first performed stand-up in 1987 at 24. And this wasn't just any start. His professional comedy career began at the legendary Comedy Store in Los Angeles. He cut his teeth in that notoriously cutthroat, often confrontational LA comedy scene of the late 80s, an environment where, legends like Sam Kinison commanded the stage with this raw, unpredictable intensity.
Bro, intense is the word.
It must have been an incredible, if not intimidating, place for a young comic to find his voice.
It's remarkable how he navigated that traditional, almost gladiatorial LA scene, only to pivot so sharply later on. He moved to New York City and became a key part of the burgeoning New York alternative comedy scene. And this wasn't just a change of location, it was a shift to a whole movement that prioritized introspection, unconventional storytelling, and a willingness to explore deeper, often uncomfortable truths over, you know, traditional setups and punchlines.
Totally different vibe.
Exactly. He was a regular at the Monday open mic nights run by Tracy Mesker at the Boston Comedy Club in Greenwich Village, a now closed venue, but legendary back then for fostering this new wave. He also got deeply involved in the live alternative stand-up series Eating It with Janine Garofalo, held at the Luna Lounge in the Lower East Side. That was a fixture in the 90s until it was demolished in 2005. This move signifies a comedian actively seeking a different kind of creative freedom, one that would become an absolute hallmark of his, well, unfiltered style.
And a crucial turning point, or maybe a near miss, comes in 1995. Marin auditioned unsuccessfully for Saturday Night Live during a big cast overhaul, and he famously attributes being passed over to being high during a meeting with Lorne Michaels.
Oof, yeah.
This wasn't just a missed opportunity, right? What did that truly mean for his creative path? Did it, maybe in hindsight, actually become a catalyst for the very authenticity he'd later be known for?
That SNL rejection, painful and perhaps self-inflicted as it might have been, is indeed a pivotal moment. It kind of prevented him from fitting into that highly structured, mainstream, sketch comedy world, and instead it pushed him to continue refining a very distinct stand-up act, an act marked by his profound commitment to self-revelation and sharp cultural analysis. He became particularly known for this relentless onstage exploration of his own relationships with family, girlfriends, other stand-up comedians he'd known and befriended.
Really putting it all out there.
Totally. This wasn't superficial stuff. It was deep, introspective, often uncomfortable work, forcing audiences to confront his anxieties right alongside him. We see this commitment in his early specials, like the HBO comedy Half Hour in 95 and Comedy Central Presents in 98 and again in 2007. His first one-man show, Jerusalem Syndrome. It had an extended off-Broadway run in 2000 and came out as a book in 2001. It really dove deep into his personal psyche. And by 2009, he was workshopping Scorching the Earth, a show he explicitly said bookended his tumultuous relationship with his second wife, Mishna Wolf, ending in a very bitter divorce. His experiences, even the most painful ones, they became his material.
That willingness to lay bare his introspection and personal struggles really sets him apart, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's a brave, often uncomfortable approach that connects deeply with audiences, maybe because it mirrors their own internal conflicts. He wasn't just telling jokes. He was kind of inviting you into his therapy session, his anxieties, his messy life.
Yeah.
That honesty about his relationships, including two divorces, became absolutely integral to his comedic voice and, as we'll soon see, a foundational element of his later podcasting success. He found a way to make the deeply personal universally relatable, and that's truly a cornerstone of his artistic philosophy. He wasn't afraid to be messy on stage, and that messiness, that rawness, it proved to be his greatest strength. Okay, so before WTF became this global phenomenon, Marin spent a significant period in radio, especially with the liberal talk radio network, Air America. And his journey through radio was marked by constant starts and frustrating stops. It consistently highlighted this pattern of his unique voice just struggling to find its place within traditional media structures.
Yeah, it was a rough ride.
His first major stint was co-hosting Morning Sedition with Mark Riley, weekdays 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern from 2004 to 2005. The show itself was quite unique in Air America's lineup. It relied heavily on both live and pre-produced sketch comedy, using staff writers and the hosts themselves.
A lot of creative energy there.
Definitely. It cultivated this left-leaning, near-satirical tone, kind of a sardonic twist on typical morning buddy radio programs. Complete with recurring characters, interviews, listener call-ins, it definitely attracted a loyal fan base, showing his early ability to connect with an audience, even in that structured broadcast environment.
Right. This early radio work is crucial because it highlights Marin's innate talent for developing unique, character-driven content and connecting with a niche audience. However, it also vividly illustrates his struggle with creative control and, frankly, a fundamental misunderstanding from network executives. The show got canceled and Marin's contract wasn't renewed in December 2005.
Why? What was the issue?
Well, the stated reason was problems with the Air America executive at the time, Danny Goldberg, who reportedly did not get the comedy or agree with the satiric and often angry tone set by Marin and his writers. It wasn't just political commentary. His sketches often used absurdism and this confrontational, intensely personal wit that was maybe ahead of its time for morning radio.
Too edgy for 6 a.m.
Perhaps. His blend of acidic observations and personal neuroses was simply too challenging, too unpredictable for traditional radio execs used to a more predictable format. This wasn't just a job ending, it was a profound clash of creative visions, an early indicator that his particular brand of humor and introspection might need a different kind of platform, one where his authenticity wasn't an obstacle, but the whole point.
So following the cancellation of Morning Sedition, Maron didn't give up on radio. He hosted the Marc Maron Show in 2006 for KTLK Progressive Talk, 11:50 a.m. in Los Angeles, 10 p.m. to midnight PST, with Jim Earl as his sidekick. But this venture was plagued with its own set of logistical challenges. The program was frequently delayed, sometimes for over an hour, because KTLK had a contract to broadcast local sports events that would often go into overtime.
Oh, that's killer for building an audience.
Right. Imagine trying to get listeners to tune in consistently when your start time is constantly shifting, preempted by extra innings. And to make matters worse, it was never nationally syndicated by Air America, despite reported contractual clauses promising that. And the online stream just wasn't well promoted. It truly felt like an uphill battle for him to even get heard, despite his clear talent.
This period further illustrates Maron's relentless persistence and his ongoing battle against the rigid limitations of traditional media structures. He was clearly trying to find a format, a platform where his voice could truly flourish, but kept hitting these external barriers that felt almost designed to stifle his unique style. This persistent desire for creative synergy eventually led to his collaboration with Sam Cedar. It started as a weekly, hour-long video webcast in September 2007.
Okay, so moving towards digital a bit.
Yeah, and this partnership evolved into Maron v. Cedar in 2008, and then Break Room Live with Maron and Cedar in 2009, both produced by Air America. What's noteworthy here is the informal setting. The show often literally took place in the actual break room of Air America Media, with cafeteria vending machines just off camera.
Seriously?
In the break room.
Seriously. Which led to occasional, almost charmingly chaotic distractions when staff and management would wander in for food and drink. They even held online post-show chats with viewers, creating this very direct, unpolished connection. It was a deliberate counterpoint to traditional broadcasting. This raw, immediate approach, born partly of necessity, was inadvertently honing his ability to craft intimate conversations and build an authentic persona, even if the traditional format couldn't ultimately contain it.
That informal, almost DIY feel, even within a network, is such a significant precursor to what came next, isn't it? It showed his ability to make compelling content out of basically nothing, in the least glamorous setting imaginable, but yet again, the axe fell.
Yep, third time's the charm.
Fair.
Break Room Live was canceled on July 15, 2009, citing financial reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And the irony here is particularly bitter. The day before the cancellation, the show got some of the first real publicity it had ever received when MaximumFun.org posted its podcast of an interview with Maron on The Sound of Young America.
Oh, that's just brutal timing.
Unbelievable. Maron's own reflection on the final webcast really captured it. He stated this was the third time since 2005 he'd been told by an executive at the network that his services would not be required. Co-host Sam Cedar pointed out it's the end of his fourth show at Air America since the troubled network start.
Wow. Just rejection after rejection.
These weren't minor setbacks. They were profound rejections, repeatedly telling him his voice wasn't suitable for their platforms. Imagine being told your services are no longer required three times by the same network. The sheer grit and artistic belief that must take to keep going.
This series of cancellations and frustrations is such a powerful narrative thread in Maron's career. It shows a consistent pattern. His unique, deeply personal voice struggling to fit into established broadcast models. This didn't just lead to professional disappointment. It pushed him into what he later called a precarious state in his comedic career, feeling lost out of options. This deep dissatisfaction, this repeated rejection, ultimately became the decisive catalyst for his greatest innovation. These radio failures weren't just professional setbacks. They were the essential pressure cooker that forced him to look for an entirely new path outside the confines of traditional media. It's a classic example of how sometimes the greatest success springs from the deepest valleys of professional disappointment. He was pushed to a point where he had nothing left to lose, and that creative freedom, born from desperation, proved utterly transformative.
And this leads us right to that pivotal moment, September 2009. Feeling professionally adrift, rejected by traditional radio, and in what he himself later called a Hail Mary pass. Marc Maron made a move that would redefine his career and, you could argue, the entire audio landscape. He started a twice-weekly podcast, WTF, with Marc Maron.
The Hail Mary that connected.
Exactly. And the crucial detail, the iconic part of this origin story, is where he started it. in his garage in Highland Park, Los Angeles. His very first guest was fellow stand-up Jeff Ross, a friend, a colleague, establishing immediately this was a show rooted in comedy, but with Marin's unique introspective twist. This wasn't some carefully planned network launch. It was a desperate, beautiful act of creation.
That origin story is absolutely iconic and profoundly resonant, isn't it? It perfectly illustrates the democratic, almost revolutionary power of podcasting. It's a low barrier to entry medium where authenticity and direct connection can genuinely triumph over high production values, corporate backing, or the perceived need for traditional gatekeepers.
Totally bypassing the old system.
Right. The garage setting in particular has become this powerful symbol of independent, raw creation, stripping away all the formality that had stifled him in radio. It left just two people, a couple of microphones, and a conversation vulnerable, unedited, and real. The stark contrast between his struggles with formal radio and the immediate embrace of his unfiltered voice on his own platform is a powerful testament to the value of creative autonomy. And it showed the hunger audiences had for something more real, more intimate, less curated. It signaled a new era where personality and genuine connection could truly trump polish and expensive production.
And that unfiltered approach quickly solidified into a signature style and, wow, massive impact. The podcast format is known for these free-form discussions where Marin and his guests delve into topics like the arc of their careers, shared past experiences, and often the deep psychological underpinnings of their art. But these aren't just surface-level chats. Marin's style is deeply personal, probing, often vulnerable, drawing out incredible insights and confessions from his guests that you simply don't hear elsewhere.
He gets people to open up like few others can.
Absolutely. The sheer scale of its success is staggering. As of 2024, he's released over 1,500 episodes of WTF, critical acclaim, over 600 million downloads globally, and the ripple effect. The success of his podcast opened up numerous other avenues in film and TV, plus it gave a massive boost to attendance at his stand-up shows. It truly became a launchpad for an entire second and arguably more impactful act of his career.
And it wasn't just another interview show. WTF was noted for its profound influence on other long-form interview podcasts that came after it. It quite literally shaped the genre. It validated a completely different style of conversation, one that was intimate, probing, and often, as you said, deeply vulnerable. The reason it was so influential, it lies in Marin's unique approach. His deeply personal questions, his unwavering willingness to share his own struggles and insecurities, and the way he encouraged guests to do the same.
Creating a real connection.
Exactly. It created this powerful sense of shared humanity, breaking down the traditional barrier between interviewer and interviewee and between celebrity and listener. It's a direct extension of his stand-up style, where that self-revelation and cultural analysis found their perfect medium in the long-form, unedited podcast conversation. Listeners weren't just hearing a famous person, they were sort of overhearing a deeply human exchange, and that proved revolutionary.
And the podcast has given us some truly landmark interviews, moments that transcended the medium, became cultural touchstones. Take, for instance, that 2010 episode with Louis C.K. Slate magazine, rated it the number one podcast episode of all time back then. Then there's the incredibly moving 2012 interview with comedian Todd Glass, where Glass publicly revealed he was gay. A deeply personal, courageously shared moment on Marin's platform that resonated far beyond comedy.
A huge moment, yeah.
And, perhaps most famously, the 2015 interview with then-President Barack Obama, who literally sat down in Marin's garage to have a conversation, bringing the leader of the free world into this deeply informal, independent setting.
Just incredible imagery there.
Right. Beyond these, Marin has hosted an unbelievable roster. Sir Paul McCartney, Robin Williams, Jerry Seinfeld, Chris Rock, Lorne Michaels, Leonardo DiCaprio, Brad Pitt. The list goes on. These are not just celebrity interviews. They're often moments of genuine connection and profound insight.
Absolutely. These landmark interviews aren't just about celebrity access. They represent moments of profound cultural significance and human connection. The Todd Glass interview, for example, showcased WTF's capacity to be a platform for deeply personal and socially impactful revelations, a space where authenticity could thrive and offer a sense of belonging. And the Obama interview, the President of the United States choosing to sit down in a comedian's garage in Highland Park. Incredibly symbolic. It was a bridging of the highly formal and the utterly informal, a tangible sign of the evolving media landscape and the power of independent voices to reach an audience directly.
What does that say about media now?
Right. What does it say about how we consume information and connect with leaders when a sitting president chooses that setting over solely traditional, more controlled media channels? And we absolutely have to mention the Robin Williams episode from April 26, 2010, deemed so significant it was selected by the Library of Congress in 2022 for preservation in the U.S. National Recording Registry as being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant.
That's amazing for a podcast born in the garage.
Truly remarkable honor.
And the recognition didn't stop there. In April 2021, Marin and his longtime producer, Brenda McDonald, received the first ever Governor's Award from the Podcast Academy for Excellence in Audio, the AMBYs, for their groundbreaking work on WTF. It's a testament to the show's lasting impact and its role in shaping the very definition of what a podcast could be, proving that a raw, authentic voice could not only succeed but actually become an industry standard. So after all this groundbreaking success, what does this all mean for the future of WTF and for Marc Maron? Well, we recently got some big news. In June 2025, Marin announced that WTF would end in fall 2025 after a remarkable 16-year run.
Wow, 16 years. That's a lifetime in podcasting.
It's truly the end of an era, a remarkable run for a show that started as that last-ditch Hail Mary effort. But even as the show winds down, its legacy and certain catchphrase will undoubtedly live on. You know that iconic phrase, lock the gates, that kicks off every episode?
Oh yeah, instantly recognizable.
It's become synonymous with WTF, a signal you're about to enter Marin's unique, often chaotic world. And it turns out its origin is from a small part credited as an angry promoter in the 2000 Cameron Crowe film Almost Famous, where he yells the line while chasing characters.
No way, I didn't know that.
Isn't that wild? A minor film role becomes this integral, recognizable part of a podcasting phenomenon.
That is a fantastic full circle moment. From a throwaway line in a minor film role to the iconic intro of a culturally significant podcast, it beautifully encapsulates Marin's journey. It's a poignant reminder that even the smallest, seemingly insignificant moments can become part of a larger, unexpected narrative, often transformed and given new meaning by an artist's later work. It also profoundly underscores how his entire life and career, the ups, the downs, the rejections, the wins, the mundane, the profound, it all became fodder for his art, for the very content that resonated so deeply with millions. And the decision to end WTF after 16 years at the height of its influence also speaks volumes about an artist's desire for new challenges, right? The courage to step away from something immensely successful.
And the ongoing evolution of a creative spirit.
Exactly. It leaves you wondering what's next, what new form his authentic voice will take as he continues to push his boundaries.
Yeah, and the overwhelming success of WTF clearly opened so many doors for Marin, particularly in film and television. It allowed him to expand far beyond his foundational work in stand-up and radio. While he had a few early film roles, like playing a comedian in the 97 mockumentary Who's the Caboose, and, of course, that brief but now legendary role as the angry promoter in Almost Famous.
The Lock the Gates guy.
The very one. His acting career truly took off after his podcast gained traction. He's also lent his distinctive gravelly voice to a surprising array of animated characters. He was in Dr. Katz, professional therapist, voiced the metal band manager Magnus Hammersmith in Metalocalypse.
Oh, yeah, Magnus. He was great.
The anxious raccoon Randall in Harvey Beaks, even a squirrel in Adventure Time. More recently, major animated film roles. The world-weary Mr. Snake in DreamWorks The Bad Guys and its upcoming sequel. And a surprisingly villainous Lex Luthor in DC League of Super Pets.
What's fascinating there is the sheer versatility and range he's shown. From voicing animated characters to more dramatic or comedic live-action roles, Marin demonstrates an adaptability that might surprise people who only know his deeply personal stand-up or his intimate podcast interviews. It raises an interesting question. How does his established persona, authentic, often neurotic, deeply introspective, how does that translate or contrast with his acting roles?
Does he bring himself to the role or disappear?
Right. Does he bring that unique Marin-esque sensibility, a certain grounded vulnerability or dry wit, or can he completely disappear into them? Mm-hmm. I mean, in GLOW, his character Sam Sylvia, while fictional, carries a similar world weariness and artistic struggle that feels deeply resonant with Marin's own journey.
Yeah, you can see the connection there.
It suggests that his commitment to authenticity in his podcast wasn't a limitation, but actually a robust foundation that allowed him to explore diverse dimensions of performance, all rooted in a relatable human core.
And the acting role certainly didn't stop there. He starred in his own IFC television comedy series, Marin. Ran for 4 seasons, 2013 to 2016, 51 episodes. The show was loosely autobiographical, revolving around a fictionalized version of his life, twice divorced, sober comedian, running the podcast out of his garage.
Sound familiar?
Very. But it deliberately established differences between the real Marin and the TV version, allowing for dramatic license while keeping that authentic core. He was deeply involved too, executive producer, occasional writer, even directed two episodes himself, The Joke and X-Pod.
The show Marin is a perfect example of his ability to fictionalize his own life while retaining that core authenticity that defines him. It let him explore themes and anxieties from his podcast and stand up in a narrative format, giving you, the listener, a chance to see how he translates that persona to a different medium, adding layers of self-awareness. His screen presence was further solidified with his co-starring role as Sam Sylvia in Netflix's GLOW from 2017 to 2019. He was in 28 episodes, got multiple award nominations, really cemented his place as a versatile character actor.
He was great in GLOW.
Definitely. He also made notable TV appearances as himself on Louie, Ted Duffield in Girls, Jacob Malko in Easy, plus roles in Reservation Dogs and The Horror of Dolores Roach. His film career also expanded, a supporting role as Gene Uffland in Joker, starring in the Lynn Shelton-directed Sword of Trust in 2019, where he also worked on the score.
Oh, right. Music, too. We'll get to that.
Playing Ron Oberman in Stardust, Sweeney in To Leslie. And he's got upcoming projects like In Memoriam, which he's also producing, and playing Chuck Plotkin in the Springsteen movie Deliver Me From Nowhere. He's clearly a sought-after talent now.
He's certainly become this in-demand actor across genres, hasn't he? Superhero films, indie dramas, playing these incredibly human, sometimes world-weary characters. It's clear that the unfiltered, deeply human voice he cultivated in his garage translated into compelling and versatile screen presence, allowing him to inhabit diverse roles while still, in many ways, being unmistakably Marc Maron. And just when you think you have him pegged, Maron surprises again with his musical contributions, showing a willingness to explore different creative avenues. In 2013, he played a guitar solo on the protest song Party at the NSA by the electropop duo Yacht.
A guitar solo from Maron.
Yep. And it was more than just a musical interlude. The song was a direct artistic response to the 2013 global surveillance disclosures critiquing government programs. All proceeds went to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the EFF.
Using his platform.
Exactly. An artist using their platform for a cause.
Mm-hmm.
And Maron himself had this wonderfully amusing quote about it. He said, mm-hmm. I have no idea why they asked me to play guitar on the track. I'm only good at one thing on the guitar. It just so happens it was exactly the thing they needed.
Huh. That is such an unexpected, delightful detail. And it perfectly illustrates Maron's unique appeal, doesn't it? He's authentic even in his limitations, and that self-awareness translates into a surprisingly effective contribution. Highlights his unpretentious approach to art. And the reviews for his solo were actually pretty good. IFC said he plays a mean guitar, Spin called it a shred fest, and angular. The Stranger noted it was better than you'd expect, although it won't make Jay Mashes jealous.
High praise, sort of.
It's a snapshot of how even seemingly disparate creative outlets can be linked by a singular, genuine artistic personality. Proving authenticity can manifest in many forms, even through a perfectly placed guitar solo. It shows an artist not afraid to step outside his primary medium, to experiment, and lend his voice or guitar to causes he believes in, further solidifying that multifaceted persona.
And his musical pursuits continued beyond that single memorable solo. He also wrote and performed on the score for his film Sword of Trust, like you mentioned, further integrating his diverse creative talents. And in 2024, he released a music recording called Signed DC, showing that his exploration of music isn't just a one-off curiosity, but maybe an ongoing, evolving part of his artistic expression. Another facet of his relentless self-exploration. Okay, so Maron's personal life isn't just background noise. It's intricately woven into his public persona and artistic output. It serves as this rich, often raw canvas for his comedy and his conversations. After living in Astoria, Queens, through the 90s and most of the 2000s, he made that significant move back to Los Angeles in late 2009, which coincided, maybe not coincidentally, with the launch of WTF.
Right, setting up shop in L.A.
And one of the most beloved and often humorous aspects of his personal life, openly discussed on his podcast, is his caring for numerous stray cats that he takes into his home. This has famously led him to refer to his home as the Cat Ranch, a kind of feline sanctuary.
Yeah, this seemingly whimsical detail about his cats and the Cat Ranch is deeply telling, I think. It profoundly humanizes him. It showcases his empathy and allows listeners to feel a more intimate, almost familial connection to the man behind the microphone. It's another layer of his relentless self-revelation, transforming personal quirks into shared narrative, a reflection of his big heart and, you know, sometimes chaotic home life.
And the catchphrases.
Oh, the catchphrases. Boomer lives! Began after his beloved cat Boomer went missing. It became this hopeful sign-off for years, a small shared moment of hope and worry with his audience. After his cat LaFonda died in December 2019, he briefly replaced it with LaFonda Lives. Then after Monkey died in August 2020, his current sign-off became the poignant and expansive Boomer Lives. LaFonda, Monkey, cat angels everywhere.
It's quite touching, actually.
It really is. He currently lives in Glendale, Los Angeles, with his two cats, Buster and Sammy. It's a testament to how Marin consistently turns aspects of his personal life, no matter how small or painful, into relatable content. Inviting you into his world and sharing his profound capacity for love and loss, even for his feline companions.
Marin has also spoken so openly in his act and on his podcast about his very real battles with alcohol and drug abuse during the 1990s, a period he often references as a particularly dark and destructive time. Thankfully, Marin has been sober since August 9, 1999. A significant milestone he often shares as a testament to personal struggle and triumph.
A huge part of his narrative.
But he also revealed his struggle with an eating disorder he developed during childhood, showing that his vulnerabilities extend beyond substance abuse to deeper formative experiences. That kind of honesty, especially about something as private as an eating disorder, it truly sets him apart.
These deeply personal struggles are not just biographical facts. They are absolutely central to his artistic identity. They form the very bedrock of his profound connection with his audience. His raw honesty about addiction and recovery resonates deeply with so many listeners, fostering this powerful sense of empathy and community. It speaks to the healing power of vulnerability, showing that profound strength can be found in sharing one's deepest challenges. And it raises an important question, doesn't it? How much of his keen insight into the human condition, particularly that of other comedians he interviews, stems directly from his own battles and the hard-won wisdom gained from them?
You have to think it informs it deeply.
His capacity for understanding the complexities of human behavior, the self-sabotage, the striving, the often painful path to self-acceptance, it seems deeply rooted in his own difficult experiences, making him a truly empathetic and insightful interviewer.
And his, well, tumultuous romantic life has often featured prominently, almost like characters, in his comedy, serving as fertile ground for his relentless self-exploration. He's been married twice, first to Kimberly Rice from 97 to 2001, then to fellow comedian Mishnah Wolf from 2004 to 2007. Both relationships, particularly the second one, have figured prominently in his act. He famously riffed on his then-recent separation and bitter divorce from Wolf at the Edinburgh Fringe in 2007, turning personal pain into public art.
Very mirror.
He's also openly discussed other relationships, breaking up with former fiancé Jessica Sanchez in 2013, a five-month relationship with Moon Zappa, and a particularly poignant and impactful relationship was with director Lynn Shelton, starting in late 2019. Shelton directed his film Sword of Trust and was a guest on WTF. Tragically, she passed away unexpectedly in 2020. This profound loss was shared so openly with his audience, deeply impacting him and further revealing his capacity for deep grief and love.
That was incredibly raw and powerful to hear him process.
As of 2023, Marin is dating a woman named Kit, continuing his journey through the complexities of human connection.
His willingness to lay bare the complexities and pain of his relationships and his art is, as you said, a cornerstone of his appeal. It's part of that relentless onstage exploration that makes him so compelling, transforming deeply personal experiences into universal themes of love, heartbreak, resilience that resonate with all of us. The tragic loss of Lynn Shelton, shared so openly and honestly, underscored the depth of his vulnerability and allowed his listeners to grieve with him, creating an even deeper, more profound bond. It demonstrates that for some artists, the line between personal life and creative output isn't just blurred, it's purposefully erased, creating a powerful, albeit sometimes painful, connection. It's a testament to the idea that true art often requires immense personal courage, a willingness to expose the deepest parts of oneself.
Finally, we should probably touch upon his turbulent longtime friendship with fellow stand-up Louis C.K. This was a relationship that, for years, was a central point of discussion and friendship within the comedy world, and often on WTF.
The huge part of the podcast's early history.
Right. However, after the November 2017 confirmation of CK's sexual misconduct, Marin publicly addressed the situation on his podcast. He stated that CK had previously lied to him about the allegations. This was a difficult public moment, highlighting the complex personal and ethical lines many in the comedy community had to navigate when personal integrity and longstanding professional relationships suddenly collided.
Yeah, that particular detail vividly illustrates the complex ethical and personal dilemmas that can arise in that tight-knit world of comedy. Marin's public statement revealing that CK had lied to him reflects his unwavering commitment to honesty and open discourse, even when it involves challenging deeply personal loyalties and a longstanding friendship foundational to his career. It wasn't about taking a political side, really, but rather a profound reflection on the personal impact of a breach of trust and the importance of truthfulness within his own artistic and personal code. It further solidifies his image as someone who values truth and direct, albeit difficult, conversation, which is absolutely central to the ethos of WTF and his overall artistic identity. Hashtag tag outro.
So what does this all mean for you, our listener? We've journeyed through Marc Maron's life, haven't we? From his transient childhood and early stand-up struggles, through the frustrating radio years that seemed to consistently reject his unique voice, to the unexpected triumph of WTF, born out of necessity in his garage. We've seen his diverse ventures in film, TV, even music, all fueled by that same authentic introspective core. We've explored his personal battles with addiction, his complex relationships, and even the comforting chaos of his beloved cat ranch. The core takeaways from his story seem to be his remarkable resilience in the face of repeated setbacks, his unwavering commitment to self-revelation, and the profound power of finding and cultivating an authentic voice, especially when, or maybe because, traditional gatekeepers tell you that you don't fit. His story isn't just about becoming a successful podcaster. It's about transforming personal pain, frustration, and vulnerability into genuine connection and unparalleled creative freedom. It's a powerful testament to the idea that sometimes your Hail Mary pass, that desperate last effort, is the one that changes everything. Not just for you, but potentially for an entire medium.
Yeah, and beyond Maron's individual path, his career poses a compelling question for all of us, I think. Whether we're artists, professionals, or just trying to navigate our own unique journeys, how might the seemingly unprofessional or deeply personal aspects of our own lives, the anxieties we hide, the past failures we lament, the quirks we try to suppress, how might those actually hold the key to our most authentic and impactful contributions? What might happen if we leaned into our own garage moments, those raw, unfiltered spaces where we have nothing to lose and maybe everything to gain by simply being ourselves? His journey invites you to consider where your own vulnerabilities might actually be your greatest strength, and how the act of truly being yourself, even when it's messy and uncertain, can open up unexpected and incredibly rewarding avenues for connection and profound success. It's about finding the courage to, well, lock your own gates and just start talking.